Hello and welcome to Dialect. Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect with Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. This week we hear all about the history of Portland Square. We also take a trip to Salisbury and the Ebble Valley to see how it's changed over the last 50 years.
Former bus conductor turned chair of transport for London has some advice to get Bristol moving. Anthea Page has her final visit to Stormont, and we also hear from a previous alcoholic brother Clifford. Charles Thompson gives us some poetry and we have a song from Tim Burrows. We also have the What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks.
Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol at least on BCFM 93.2. Elsewhere we are also broadcast in Swindon, so hello to our Swindon FM listeners. Also on Preston FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you're in Bristol and you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square, and you can look them up on the internet. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline. It aims mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show.
Well, joining us is Betty Burke, who's author of Cinderella Square, A History of Portland Square. Hi, Betty. Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, I've lived in Portland Square for many years now, and it's such an interesting square. When I moved into number 25, I was given, of course, the deeds of the property. And even then, I thought this would be a wonderful book to write or perhaps to research. But when the Perian Centre opened at number 27, I saw this beautiful house. And I picture myself walking down the curved staircase in my rustling silk. And I knew that I had to find out about all the women who had lived there for the past 200 years.
Because it has got that quality, hasn't it? I think if you're there in the evening time sometimes, you could almost imagine coach and horses coming around the corner. The council have actually done quite a good job for a change in sort of restoring the old railings, making sure that, you know, some of the original Georgian features are still there. Can you just give us an idea, though, about how it all started? You know, whether it was designed to live in or as a place for sort of merchants to work and offices? Because now, I think it's probably fair to say that most of the places are businesses and solicitors, that kind of thing, rather than houses.
Well, originally, of course, they were all houses, probably one of the most expensive houses in the country. It sounds like a little bit of money now, but they had to be £1,000 per house, which was probably £2 million now. So they were splendid, splendid places to live.
And also they had sort of coach houses and things out the back as well, right around that outside of the square.
Yes, yes.
So rather than garages and cars parked everywhere, people had their own horses even stabled there.
Yes, and carriages. Yes, indeed. Footmen, many servants, and only the rich could afford to, or the wealthy could afford to live there.
Also, what about water? How did they get their water when the places were originally built?
Most of them, I think, had wells. Certainly number 27 has a well, which is a feature now. It would come down through the guttering into cisterns, probably. Yes. But, of course, nobody drank water in those days.
Nobody drank water?
Nobody drank water.
What did they drink?
They drank a very weak beer, wine, but water, I'm afraid, was very very dicey. Yeah.
Well, tell us about some of the famous residents of the square, because I know there's an Oscar Wilde connection.
Yes, indeed. That is Godwin, a very famous architect who designed the carriage works, helped restore St Mary Redcliffe, and was very interested in Japanese design. And in fact, he started a fashion which was called Anglo-Japanese. And who else lived there?
Try to jog your memory a bit. Ellen Terry?
No, she didn't actually live there. But she was, a few years, she was playing at the Prince's Theatre, which was burned down during the war. And she became very friendly, although she was only about 16 at the time, became very friendly with the Godwins. He was head of the Shakespearean Company, I think, and she used to do readings at his house in number 21. And I don't know whether I should tell this story, but many years later they became lovers and had two children. And yes, so that was quite a connection with Ellen Terry.
Also, what about the church? St Paul's Church is one of the most incredible features in the city, really, the old Christmas tree church.
Christmas tree church, yes, it is really beautiful. And there's a bit of confusion as to who designed the squares and who designed the church. There's William Hague, who is probably the favourite. And it was a most unusual church because it should have been flat like the houses, but he rather fancied this beautiful as you say, wedding cake church, and it is quite a feature.
The other thing we have to say is almost, I mean, I feel terrible saying it, but part of the square is actually just about falling down, isn't it? How long has it been like that, and is there any prospect for it to be restored?
I think it's been like that since the war, with the bombing. Well, various plans have been trying to set afoot. There is planning for flats, if ever it comes to pass, because it really is an eyesore. The rest of the square is absolutely beautiful. And just those numbers, I think it's 29 to 33. Yes, it's really spoiling the square.
It's dreadful, isn't it? And I wonder if, you know, you can explain why it is that someone can own a place like that and yet, you know, just leave it in that dreadful state. What's the motivation?
Well, it is a business. It is a business, and people are running a very successful business and, of course, don't want to move.
I suppose that's behind the actual facade.
Yes, yeah, indeed, okay. Indeed. It runs into Surrey Street, which is a street off the square.
So it was put up as a temporary thing after the war damage, and yet it's not actually been changed ever since. So they've got planning permission to do something with it. What's that?
Yes, yes, flats, and I think a shop. It just needs a bit of persuasion for the owners to sell, I think.
I suppose since we're on the radio, we ought to also mention the fact that one of Bristol's favourite radios, which started as a pirate station, was there too.
Ah, yes, indeed. Yes, FTP, For the People, started there at where I live, at number 25. And this was taken over by Galaxy Radio and was there for many years. And that was very exciting because people would come and go and
Well, a lot of people say that it kind of lost it once it was taken over by a commercial business, and it wasn't so much fun after that.
Probably not. Nothing ever is.
And also, what about the statue? Because there was a statue for a while, wasn't there, of George III,
right
in the centre. Now, what about that? I mean, what happened to that?
Well, that was knocked down by a gentleman called, I think his name was John Orator Hunt. And he would go around inflaming the passions all around Britain. And he came and inflamed the passions of the people in Bristol. And I think he was for Princess Charlotte. And they didn't want, I think it was George III's son. My history is terrible. And they came one night and tied a rope around the statue, pulled it over, fell with a resounding smash. And that was the end of George III.
At what point did it stop becoming a place where people lived and start becoming taken over by businesses, and why was that?
It was quite early on. The square was only fashionable for perhaps 40 years, say.
And from what time was that, roughly?
That was about 1820 to 1860. Then, I'm afraid, Clifton was built, and they all left to go and live in Clifton, which was really sad.
So why is it that you so enjoy living there? What is it you think is the big attraction of the place?
Well, for me, it's just the beauty of the square, the Georgian architecture, the wonderful garden, and it's just exciting.
You've got a sense of history as well, haven't you? Okay, so the book is Cinderella Square, A History of Portland Square by Betty Burke, and thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you for having me.
Next up, we've got a feature from Tony Gosling. This was originally courtesy of Wiltshire Sound, BBC Wiltshire Sound, back in the day. And Tony is talking to Peter Berenius.
I'm Peter Berenius, and we're at Coombisset on the banks of the River Ebble.
Tell me about the condition of the river this year.
It is more discoloured than I have ever seen it during any May in the whole of my 60 years that I've known the Ebble. I'm 72 and I've fished the Ebble for over 60 years. Generally, at this time of year, it will be running crystal clear with great banks of water buttercup weed, beds of very clear gravel, and masses of trout rising in the channels between the weed. As we look at it now, we can see it is a sort of murky brownish grey colour. There's hardly any growing ranunculus. There's certainly no fish rising whatever, and this should be the height of the trout fishing season when there should be fish rising everywhere. There are a number of factors which have contributed to the decline of our chalk streams. First and foremost, undoubtedly, the low rainfall that we've experienced for the last 5 years, the long-term average has not been reached for the last 5 years. And that's absolutely exceptional. It very often happens that long-term average is not reached for 1 or 2 years, but then it's always made up by 1 or 2 years of above long-term average rainfall. But what we've had in the last 5 years has been a consistent below long-term average rainfall. This has caused the aquifers to become depleted, the underground sources of the water which feed all these chalk streams, and our rivers are running incredibly low for the time of year. In a change in wildlife since when I first came to the Ebble Valley for my holidays in 1929, 1930 onwards, is absolutely phenomenal. We used to hear every evening a bird called the curlew. That usually presaged rain, and practically every evening you had rain promised by the song of the curlew, and it arrived the next day. I have not heard a curlew in this valley for over 30 years now. It has completely disappeared. We used to have immense flocks of plover, the green plover, sometimes known as the peewit, I think is its popular name. These are almost non-existent now in this valley. We get a few of them, but there used to be thousands, and now there are probably dozens where there used to be thousands. Now, the reason for those changes is the change in agricultural use of the land. When I was a child, they used to have what they called hatches, little adjustable dams, every quarter of a mile, all the way down the river. These hatches were used to raise the water level in the early spring, and
just to hold the river back.
To raise the water level in order to be able to divert the river all over the fields in the little side ditches, which were called carriers, for carrying water all over the fields.
Now, interestingly enough, you're trying a similar sort of experiment yourself here, where you've placed a weir in the river just at the back of your house, and you're diverting the river over a space of something like 15, 20 yards, quite a distance over into the old water meadows here.
The purpose of this is to raise the soil moisture density in this little meadow way in, and to try to restore the whole environment to the type of environment we had 30 or 40 years ago. I remember some of these old Wiltshire characters that impressed me so much as a small boy. I was born in London, spent most of my life in towns, but every summer we came down here, and I was immensely impressed by the way the labourers used to talk about their experiences. I remember there was a man who did some gardening for my mother, and she complained to him, "You know, those blackbirds, they're doing an awful lot of harm. They're eating all our soft fruit up." And he replied, "Mum, in my opinion, it's two-legged birds that are taking them fruits." Of course, he meant thieves. So that was one of our favourite phrases. He was a great gossiper, that gardener, and I can still see him in my mind's eye leaning on his fork and saying, "Well, there's some people in the villages I shouldn't like to mention. For instance, there's old Mrs. So-and-so," and then up would come some scandalous piece of gossip. In fact, it always became a phrase in our family, "some people as I shouldn't like to mention." He always mentioned them immediately after he said he wouldn't like to mention them. The Ebble Valley is famous for being a place where one lady who wanted to be alone lived for considerable periods just after the war, and that was Greta Garbo, who lived somewhere up around Broadchalk, if I remember rightly. I must say I never met her because she was a lady who wanted to be alone, but it certainly must have suited anyone who was of a solitary disposition, particularly in those days. There was hardly anyone in the Ebble Valley apart from the local people. In the Wiltshire streams, most of the fish will take bread.
So does that mean that the folk can just wander down by the side of the river and flick bread in like they would feed for the trout, like they would feed the ducks?
Yes, as long as the pieces of bread are not too large, it will almost certainly bring trout up if there are any trout around. And most of the village boys know this perfectly well, actually, and get very unpopular with the fishermen as a result.
Why is that unpopular with the fishermen? Surely it's nothing wrong with just feeding the trout.
Oh, feeding them is all right, but when you feed them with the hook attached, it's a different story, isn't it?
That was Peter Berenius talking to Tony Gosling there about the River Ebble in Wiltshire and how it's changed over the last 50 years. Without it now, London would be unthinkable. Queues everywhere and aggro every time you change trains or buses. I'm talking about the London Travel Card, of course, which was introduced in the 1980s. And there may be a lot of lessons for public transport in Bristol when we realise that lower fares can actually bring in more money in fares. Now, even though Dave's party won the 1981 Greater London Council election based on their plans for reducing London Transport's fares, the vandals in Ermine at the appeal court ruled the GLC were not allowed to do it and ordered them to increase fares to a price higher than they were before. Then Margaret Thatcher abolished the Greater London Council entirely. Anyway, Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to former bus conductor Dave Wetzel, the man who brought the travel card to London and who first mooted the congestion charge, in the final part of this interview.
In the 1980s, we actually put forward a manifesto for the GLC where we talked about the carrot and the whip. And the carrot was a major improvement to public transport and a huge reduction in fares. The whip was road pricing. And we said we won't introduce the whip in our 4-year, which turned out to be a 5-year term of office. So there was never any question that we would introduce road pricing or congestion charging because we'd actually dismissed it in our manifesto. And we tried to stay true to the manifesto, to the promises that we made to the people of London if they would elect us. What we did do was to try and generate the debate. We discovered that the previous Conservative administration had had a consultancy report kept secret on the whole question of congestion charging and how it might operate. So we published that report to create a debate. Had we introduced congestion charging then, it would, I believe, been very successful, as indeed it was eventually when Ken did it as mayor, and it would have meant that a lot of people who have died in road accidents in the intervening years would still be alive today. We've been able to pump the money from congestion charging into the public transport system, into walking initiatives and cycling initiatives.
But it's almost impossible, Dave, to sell another tax. It's got to be sort of brought in by stealth, hasn't it? This is just another charge that people have got to pay in already one of the most expensive cities in Britain.
Ken put it forward in his election manifesto when he stood as an independent in 2000. He was the only candidate, other than the Green candidate, of course, who would have brought in congestion charging in their first term of office. He won that election quite overwhelmingly and was therefore pledged to do it. And the very first conversation I had with him after he appointed me as vice chair of TfL was that it was imperative that we got congestion charging in within 2 years so people should have 2 years of experience of it before they had to vote in the next mayoral election. We missed that target for understandable reasons, but it did come in about 15 months before the re-election, and it was a huge success from day one in terms of reducing traffic in London. Yes, it's costly. It's a costly system. You have to have hundreds of cameras. You have to have a call centre. You have to have computers. You have to have the going round to people, making sure, you know, if they've not paid, that they get the penalties and all the rest of it. All that paraphernalia is expensive. And about half the money we collected went on collecting. So as a tax, it's not a good tax. You wouldn't recommend congestion charging just to raise money. But as a method of reducing congestion, then it's quite brilliant. Obviously, over time, the charge itself reduces against inflation, and so therefore you have to keep increasing the charge to keep it at current levels. But Nobody wants to take it out completely. Boris wants to take it out of the western extension. But the heart of congestion charging in the heart of London will remain, even under Boris Johnson, the Conservative mayor.
But it is a regressive tax, isn't it? It means it's much easier for the rich to drive around London than the poor will just simply have to leave their car at some point and get public transport in, because it's a flat rate and poor people are hit much harder by that.
I don't know about Bristol, but in London, most of the poor people were already on the buses, some of them on the trains, but the very poor tend to buy bus passes and not use the trains. If you tax the people that are coming into London, or charge them for the congestion charge, it's not a tax. If you collect that money from the people who can afford to bring cars into London, then, and use that money to improve the public transport system, then the poor people are actually benefiting. Because now, instead of waiting 20 minutes for a bus, they get a bus every 15 minutes or every 10 minutes. So their journey is quicker, and the fares are reasonable, or they were before Boris started bringing in his huge increases. We reduced the cost of the weekly bus pass and enabled poor people to travel around London in a much more convenient way than they could have done before. And a lot of low-paid people also use cycling, and we made more cycle lanes and more facilities for cycle parks, parking, so that people on low incomes actually benefit from our policies. Congestion charge, except for the one or two rare cases that the press are always able to pick on, generally congestion charging penalises richer members of society, and it encourages and enables poorer people to get around. But the beauty, I think, of congestion charging is that people have switched from cars to public transport, and I want to see people in bowler hats and top hats using public transport.
Former Chair of Transport at the Greater London Council there, Dave Wetzel, with possibly some lessons to get Bristol's public transport working better.
Anthea Page has been in Northern Ireland, and this is part three of her feature about Stormont, the seat of Irish politics.
This is the Senate Chamber now, that's its official title. This is the opening of Parliament in Belfast City Hall in 1921, opened by King George V and Queen Mary. William Connor was the locally renowned artist commissioned to do this for about 200 guineas at the time, but he only received 131 guineas and 6 shillings. There were three reasons why he fined him. First of all, William Connor was an artist, apparently, that painted exactly as he seen what was in front of him at all times. So we have King George V here, and his wife is taller than him. But he shouldn't have did that, because the rule was, if you're painting the monarch standing, they have to be taller than everybody else that's standing. And never mind the Queen Mary being taller, her lady-in-waiting at the very back there, she's even taller again. Another reason why he lost out was because the ladies, mainly the wives of the members in the middle here, they weren't very happy because you can't really see their beautiful faces. It's all about vanity, this painting. And then the guys in the middle here, the members elected, they were paying for this out of their own pocket, and you can't really see their faces either. They weren't happy about that. Poor Billy Connor lost out there. It is now worth $250,000. The one across the way was commissioned by Lord Alderdice, the initial Speaker of the House here, of the Alliance Party, and he was appointed as Speaker by Mo Molam, the Labour government's Northern Ireland Secretary at the time, of course very heavily involved with the Good Friday Agreement, which is why this was commissioned as well. The reason why he was appointed as Speaker was apparently they couldn't agree between themselves who the Speaker should be, so he was appointed by her. Nowadays, all agreed that Willie Heather would be the Speaker of the House, and he is. He's the Chief Speaker of the DUP, but once he's in the chamber as a Speaker, he doesn't belong to his party. He has to remain neutral. He doesn't even have a casting vote in the chamber either. If it does come down to a split vote within the chamber, if it's 50-50 completely, the issue will fall. It doesn't go to a second vote or a casting vote. It falls. That's how it's to work here, really, as well. We do have other deputy speakers, of course. Say, for instance, we have Francie Molloy of Sinn Féin, but once he's in the chamber, he's independent as well. The initial First Minister would have been David Trimble of the Ulster Unionist Party and Seamus Mallon, Deputy First Minister of the SDLP. Of course, those two parties, respectively, were the bigger parties at the time, representing the different communities here. Now that has changed, of course. We have the First Minister, which is Peter Robinson of the DUP, who stepped in after Dr. Paisley here stepped down after a year as First Minister, and Martin McGuinness of Sinn Féin as Deputy First Minister. Gerry Adams, President of Sinn Féin still, but I think even when he was here as the leader of the party within Assembly here, he took a back seat role more or less, and maybe let Marty do all the hard work. But he's now down in Dublin, of course. Monica McWilliams of the Women's Coalition. Then with the Republicans coming into the political fold here, so did the Loyalists then as well. And then we have Billy Hutchinson and David Irvine of the Progressive Unionist Party. David Irvine unfortunately died 5 years ago, and he is a very missed voice in these parts. He was a very intelligent man, and we affectionately called him, of course, Dictionary Dave. I think his favourite saying was, why use a small word when a big word would suffice? Sammy Wilson here, Finance Minister. A member that has stopped being a member for the Legislative Assembly, MLA, Noel Murphy, commissioned for £45,000. He did get the full £45,000. They did make 100 prints and sold them at £450 each, so the £45,000 also went to charity too at the same time. But Noel Murphy was apparently approached by a lot of these members around the time that he was painting it. Apparently they asked him, oh here, put me more to the front of the painting, would you? So that when he came to paint it, those he asked to be made more to the front of the painting, he put them all the way to the back, on purpose. Apparently that's a true story. I haven't been able to ask Noel himself. He is still alive. This is now worth £150,000. It might be worth a bit more, but he hasn't died yet.
So we're crossing now from the Senate chamber to the Commons chamber, which is directly opposite, and this chamber's blue.
We like to think it's to do with the flax. Flax plant, colour of its flower is blue. Nicely coincides with the fact that we'll have a blue chamber. It's a real nice nod to the past and what made Belfast great in the first place. Flax plant is, apparently it was the idea of Lord Alderdice himself, who was the first speaker of the most recent assembly that we've had here. He got the idea for the flax plant from his own family's crest. The Alderdice family name will always be synonymous with this place. Six flowers to represent each of the counties of Northern Ireland as well.
We're sitting down in the Commons Chamber.
This is where it all goes on a Monday and Tuesday. Committees take up about 3 days a week. Certainly the Agriculture Committee is always on a Tuesday. The committee days are normally Wednesday and Thursday. And they work well together. You know, it's quite amazing to see. But they either share the same constituency or they're in constituencies that are side by side. You know, so they're working for each other's constituents. Once a member walks through the door, just like in Westminster as well, they nod towards the chair. There's no symbolism whatsoever. It's completely bare. There was a one party in particular that says there should be nothing in here so that we can just get on with our work, more or less. But there would have been a royal standard above the Speaker's chair, just like there is on the one above the Speaker's chair across the way. It apparently goes back to before the Great Fire of London, whereby the chamber in the Palace of Westminster was St Stephen's Chapel. There used to be a crucifix that the people bowed towards. but then up towards the royal standard. They're bound to the seniority of the monarch. But they still do the bow, of course, apart from Sinn Féin. They're publicans. They don't recognise a monarchy. But there is a story to do with that. Barry Muckleduff says it quite often, often himself, a member of Sinn Féin, that a couple of years ago, Martin McGuinness came walking through those doors. Of course, Sinn Féin don't bow, but he tripped over himself. But Martin McGuinness, now, you're sitting in Peter Robinson's seat, First Minister. Martin sits over in this one. They are complete equals within the position. Two people, one position. If you were to resign, he has to resign straight away. If you were to propose anything, he has to support it, vice versa. That's basically the way it is here. It is also laid out so that the largest party sits to the right of the Speaker and the second largest party sits to the left of the Speaker. But in Westminster, that's the government and the opposition. But we don't have an opposition here. It is a power-sharing executive. They're all working together for the benefit of all the electorate here. That's why we also have six members for each constituency currently as well. Basically, at the time, that was to bring in the smaller parties, such as the PUP or the Women's Coalition and things like that. They were brought in, and more independents as well, you know, fuller representation, really. And then whatever percentage that the party has within here, that percentage is also reflected in the membership makeup of the committees that they have here, and also the amount of questions that you can ask. That's all called the de Hunt system. But the DUP are on this side. The First Minister doesn't sit in the first seat, the Chief Whip does. So you tell them all how to vote. Although Peter tells you how to tell them all how to vote, that's the difference. If Sammy Wilson is in here, you'll get a few more members coming in. But we have our department ministers, like our cabinet here, sit around the front bench. We also have our party leaders, officials' boxes at the back for civil servants, committee staff, whatever. They can't come into the chamber through those very back doors. So officially, they're officials' doors, but unofficially, public gallery up above. Mondays and Tuesdays, if you might find yourself at a bit of a loose end in Belfast, you can come up, you can approach our ushers out in the Great Hall, and they'll escort you and make sure you get up into the public gallery there as well. Press gallery up here, but not really used as such anymore. Press, they always have to have their iPads or their tablets or their mobiles with them. You're not allowed them in here. But official recorders would sit up there. If you're a minister presenting a bill, you can stand and talk for as long as you want, and they do, you know, 2-3 hours, they'll be up giving up millions. As a punter within the chamber that wants to ask a question, you're normally given about 5 minutes. Now, you can, if you want, speak in any other language but English, but 5 minutes isn't very long. So they might just say, Dora Melgadan Cordia, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, because 5 minutes isn't very long, really. Like, take up half the time in the language you want to speak in, and the second half in English. You've only got really 2.5 minutes.
Just tell me who the member was who was murdered.
Well, we've had a couple of members, actually. Norman Strong, Edgar Graham, and then also up until 1972, there's dedications across in the Senate Rotunda for two senators that were killed during the Troubles as well. So that's two across there, and then two members that were killed during the Troubles. I think Norman Strong was actually Speaker of the House as well. And then his father was involved with politics, or his son too, possibly, as well. Then, fingers crossed, those really are times of the past that belong in the past, you know.
Thank you very much to Anthony Page. Reformed alcoholic and travelling evangelist Brother Clifford visited Bristol recently to tell homeless people about his journey from death's door to travelling around Europe, talking about his experiences and answering difficult questions about his faith. Dialect's Tony Gosling caught up with him in his van as he was passing Bristol on his way to Denmark to start yet another year of touring churches and house groups all over Europe.
Hello, my name's Brother Clifford. I'm just a person that the Lord has touched because I'm an evangelist who travels Scandinavia, the Baltic areas, and the whole of Great Britain. The Lord calls us brothers and friends. He told me right at the beginning to title myself as a brother, and that is the way it is.
Now, some people will say, you know, God is speaking to you in your head. Maybe this is just voices in your head. Maybe you're bonkers.
Maybe I am a little bonkers, but not as far as Jesus is concerned. People wonder about this voices in the head thing, and I always try to analyse it. Everyone has a conscience, We all know right from wrong, and sometimes there's a little tiny thing inside of us that says, don't do this or don't do that. And that is the way the Lord speaks to me. Sometimes it's a feeling, sometimes it's a quiet voice. And I seem to be able to interpret what the Lord is saying as he speaks that way.
Now, you seem to be almost saying it's like having an angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other. I don't think it's really like that, though, is it? And many people would characterise that as a bit silly.
Well, we're definitely not into demonology, because there are no demons around here. But I do believe in angels. Otherwise, they wouldn't be written about in the Bible.
So how do you know if you say angels exist and you believe in them?
He does say in the Word that we shall be surrounded by a host of angels. He also says that when we go to heaven, that we shall judge the angels. Don't forget, when they went into the tomb after Christ died, the first thing they came across was an angel sat there.
But none of us have seen angels, or very few of us anyway, would even say we've ever seen them. I mean, for most people, this is just poppycock.
Yes, he does say, though, you will meet angels unaware. An angel is a being from heaven. Most people think it's going to be a person in a white garment and wearing wings. If we're going to meet them unawares, they'll just look like you and I. But an angel, well, that's not the way I'm speaking of it. I'm speaking of the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is the one that the Lord sent to earth, part of the Trinity, and he is the one that directs my path.
Now, your path takes you all around the place. We're sitting in your van now, which you use to travel right round Europe.
Yes, well, not right round Europe. Last year, I think we did 19 countries. But this year, we'll be setting off on Tuesday for the Faroe Islands via Denmark. Probably take a trip up to Iceland whilst I'm there, taking the van with me. And then after that, it's through Denmark, Sweden, Finland, up through Lapland, right to the top of Norway, as far as you can possibly travel. And then I follow the Russian border all the way down through Lapland, Finland. Then I cross the sea and into Estonia and continue through Latvia into Lithuania to the top of Poland and Belarus. All the way I will be praying that the Lord will touch people.
It sounds to me, though, like you're actually burning up a lot of fossil fuels.
Well, I don't know about burning up a lot of fossil fuels, but the Lord did supply the fossil fuels for us. And he also gives me the finance to keep on going.
So how do you get this special bank transfer from God, then?
It's not a special bank transfer. Everywhere I go, people seem to want me to come and speak in their churches or their house groups. Or the Lord just lays it on people's hearts and they help to finance me. But it's a non-profit-making organisation, this. I start off the year with practically nothing, and at the end of the year I still have nothing. I just live day by day, depending upon the Lord in faith.
How did you get into this?
How did I get into it? Well, my father was an alcoholic, and all I remember as a child was this drunken man shouting and abusing his children and his wife. And I always said I would never, ever touch alcohol. But of course I did one day, and it didn't affect me. But within 3 years, I'd lost my career as a singer, I'd lost my wife, I'd lost my home, and I finished up living on the streets of London. I stayed there for over 20 years. Eventually, my family found me and found me a little home to live in. After that, it was hospital and hospital to be dried out so often. 33 times they dried me out. And on the last time in 1996, I came out of hospital, and the doctor told me that I only had 6 months to live. Throughout those 6 months, I knew I was dying. The pain in my liver got worse. I had cirrhosis. I had brain damage. And right at the end, I knew I was dying. I had no strength. I was yellow. And I just said one day, Lord, if you're there, I will serve you. And in a way, I realised that Jesus was alive. And I set off in 1996, August. I still had about 2 or 3 weeks left to live, or the doctor told me. He actually banned me from leaving, but I went and started the travelling. And for a while I go away for a few weeks and then come back, go away for a few weeks, come back, just standing on the streets telling people that Jesus loved them, singing, earning the money to keep going. And then after a year, we got an old car and then an old van. And it's grown and grown and grown. It's taken 16 years up to now. Many people remember that I was driving buses, double-deckers, single-deckers. But each time I went out, the Lord was increasing it. About 6 years ago, I gave up my home. And I've been travelling ever since. Not as a gypsy, not as a traveller. I'm a travelling evangelist for Jesus. But my main task is to pray for people.
But you were right on the edge for a long, long time. Why did it take you so much time to actually accept Christ?
Because I'm human. I didn't want to accept Christ. Who does want to accept Christ? He takes away freedom. But you don't realise how much freedom you get when you get to know him. There are rules you have to follow if you're a Christian. People say how difficult it is to become a Christian, how difficult it is to be a Christian. But most of those people don't know what it is anyway. The greatest, the most wonderful decision I ever made, I made under duress, and that was to follow Christ. And I'll tell you, if anybody had a chance of finding Christ and it meant me going living on the streets again for another 20 years, I would do it for them, because it's the most wonderful thing. You see, Jesus has told me I shall never, ever die. He told me that right at the beginning in that little silent voice I hear. You shall never die. One day you might stop breathing, but you shall never die, because you shall live for eternity with me. What a wonderful promise.
Quite a lot of Christians seem to spend most of their time thinking about heaven and don't necessarily act and do things in the here and now.
Well, I don't judge other people if I can help it. As far as I'm concerned, the Lord has said, if you bring one person to me, it's worth more than anything. Jesus is real. Jesus is alive. And all I can do is tell people. But they all have free will. That's the wonderful thing about Christianity. You have free will to say yes or no. A lot of people think you die and you go to heaven. Maybe. But you go to heaven for the judgment. And what's he going to say to you? If you didn't follow me, get away from me. I did not know you. If you followed me for the wrong reasons, like finance or popularity or power, get away from me, I don't want to know you. Hell is a real place, and I ain't going there. I know I'm not going there because I follow my Jesus and I love him.
It does sound like a very harsh God that's just going to, you know, because you put one step wrong, throw you into hell.
I don't think he's going to be quite so judgmental, because Jesus says he is the propitiation for our sins. He is the one that can say, forgiven. And it says in that when we go to the judgment seat, he will judge us, not God. God has given Jesus authority to cancel out sin. And he cancels out sin because he died. He shed his blood. He sat on that cross for 3 hours. He was scourged 39 times with the cat of nine tails. And now he is able to dispense the justice of God. You see, many people live in the Old Testament. They live in the place where everything is judgmental. It's a very harsh God. It's war. It's murder. But not this Jesus. This Jesus says, love God and love your neighbour as yourself. That's what I try to do.
Brother Clifford there, reformed alcoholic and travelling evangelist in his van, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling, and we'll have the final part of his story next week. It's my pleasure to introduce, for a bit of poetry, Mr. Charles Thompson. Hello.
Hello, John.
You help organise the Lansdowne Poets, and I understand you've, well, by the looks of your grubby fingers, you've been in the allotment today.
Well, it's a marvellous day. Today I've been down to the allotment and I've been weeding the blackcurrants and the raspberries and preparing the potato bed. In fact, the potatoes went in, so I've had a great day. The wind was blowing, the sun was shining. It was absolutely fantastic.
Very productive.
It was fantastic, yeah. So I've got a poem here, and it's about one of my favourite vegetables. I don't know if it's one of yours, and it's called spinach. Spinach ain't much at the co-op. It's baby leaf if it's a day. And besides this, freshly washed and reduced. I really don't like spinach that way. I mean, if you really like spinach, you like it up front and rude. Spinach is gritty and wholesome. It's a gutsy veg, even a little bit crude. I got mine in a shop that's organic, wrapped sweet with stalks and large leaves. There's absolutely no need to panic. It's got everything a good spinach needs. It's big, is this kind of spinach, and it comes from just down the road, where volunteers planted and cherished it and watched it grow dark green and loud. It's both stalk and the leaf which you eat. Get the stalk first and then chop it. Cook it till it's mellow and soft. Put it to one side for a minute and bubble the leaf in a fraction of water, flipping it over as the water gets hotter. Then have with the stalk brown rice and some butter. It's utter, it's utter, it's utter, it's utter delight. Yes, spinach has got a fantastic sharp taste. It's not really for someone called Brian. You don't say, oh, how fresh, how exciting. But, wow, this has got zing, it's got iron. And yes, it jolly well has got iron.
Charles Thompson, thank you very much.
Okay, cheers. Thank you very much for doing that.
It's time to welcome, as ever, the charming and wonderful Jeff Sparks for a What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. On Friday 20th of April, Saturday 21st of April and Sunday 22nd of April, New Revolution Music Promotions present Twisted Delusions at the Griffin in 41 Colston Street, Bristol. Headlining the Friday night from Exeter is groove metal group Mad Hatter 2.0. On the Saturday from Chippenham is metalcore group Dissolute. And on the Sunday, the headliners are Bristol's own Cider Punks, Surf and Turnips. On the Friday, expect performances from Zoltar Speaks, Alien Stash Tin, Bone Mud, Immersed Earth and many other acts. On the Saturday, there's performances by Road to Nowhere, Throne of Demise, The Vast and many other acts. And on the Sunday, there's performances from The Setbacks, TLI, Hater UK, The Richard Heads and many other acts. Day tickets are £3.50 in advance for Friday and Saturday, £4 in advance for the Sunday, and weekend tickets are £10 each. Tickets can be purchased either from the Griffin in Colston Street, Bristol Ticket Shop, or from any of the bands performing over the weekend. For more information, you can check out Twisted Delusions event page on Facebook.com. On to Song of the Week, and I present C6 Steve. This blues musician started his career in 2001 and to date has released 5 studio albums. This is from the album Doghouse Music, which was released in 2006, and is the track Doghouse Boogie.
I figured I'd do it better on my own. Well, been followed a number of years of bumming around and living kind of hand to mouth. Sometimes getting locked up and such, and sometimes just going cold and hungry. I didn't have me no real school education, so what in the hell of what I was gonna be able to do? But I always did pick on the guitar, used to put the hat out for spare change. Well, now I'm making this here record for y'all, and I'm still trying to get your spare change. I don't know why it went wrong, it ain't bad now, but I just keep playing my doghouse music and sing the doghouse song.
That was C6 Steve with Doghouse Boogie from the album Doghouse Music. For more information, you can check out www.c6steve.com. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Take care, Jeff.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday at 2 p.m. It's also broadcast in Preston and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download the weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our reporters this week, Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. We also had some poetry, courtesy of Charles Thompson. Thank you very much to Tim Burrows for his musical talents and for Jeff Sparks for the What's On. The producer was Tony Gosling.
And studio production this week was by Michael Noyce. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to do so, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised again, here's the number for Bristol Bully Watch, 01454 318753. That was Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman.